Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We've got a lot of electricity percolating through the show this morning. We'll start in Barrie at Wilkins Harley-Davidson, where they're working on something amazing. Then we'll learn about some moves that might be hurdles to the state's renewable energy goals. At 10, we'll celebrate Student Employment Month with a Champlain College student who's lighting things up with her boundless energy. And we'll finish learning about a Vermonter hoping to give diversity a jump start with some of the books and toys she's designed for young people. But let's get this show on the road and revved up at Wilkins Harley-Davidson. Joining me is the customer experience manager, Mark the Owl Frano. Mark, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I think you're the first person I've ever had on the show that I introduced with a nickname right off the bat. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Mark a Harley question or about owls or even bologna sandwiches, we'll get to that. You can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mark, what can you tell us about the history and legacy of Wilkins Harley-Davidson?
Well, Rick, Wilkins Harley-Davidson has been in Barrie since 1947. Now, my math's not so good, but that's 70-plus years. It was started by Harry Wilkins on a little at his home, actually, in his garage up on Farrell Street. So we've got a long history here. We grew from a 200-square-foot garage, which was our showroom and our service bay, everything in a dirt floor, so small, Harry had to pull his desk in and out to make sure that there was room enough for his guests. We've grown from that to today, which is a beautiful modern facility here in Barrie.
Well, I'll do the math for you. It is the 75th anniversary of what's going on there. It is the semisesquicentennial of Wilkins Hardware. How's that?
Well, that's a $10 word, and I'll take your word for it. It's above my head, but I get it.
Hey, Mark, there are 650 Harley-Davidson dealers in the country. So what makes Wilkins different from the others?
Well, I think basically what makes us different is that we've really stayed in line with what Harry started in 1947. I mean, we were really just standing on his shoulders and executing his whole philosophy that started so many years ago. And I think that's what makes us unique is that we remain sort of old school in a lot of ways. I mean, we're a modern facility and we're certainly representing modern machines. But the way we do things here is really old school. And it has to do with hospitality. It has to do with understanding that folks have a lot of options in terms of where they can buy their Harley-Davidson. And frankly, the product is the same everywhere you go. The difference is your experience when you're acquiring that motorcycle. And Harry knew that back in 1947. And because we're three generations under the same roof, that's been carried on. And we're just doing things the Harry way, really.
Well, you're doing something very interesting. It's the Live Wire motorcycle. Tell us what that is.
So the Live Wire is Harley-Davidson's first electric, all-electric motorcycle. Which is quite a departure from our tradition, but it is the right motorcycle for the right time, and we're seeing a lot of brands offering electric variations on their traditional platforms. I mean, we see Ford's F-150 has got an electric pickup truck, and well, it's just natural that a progressive company looks forward, and Harley-Davidson has done that, and offering the LiveWire puts us squarely in the progressive camp in terms of looking to what motorcycles might look like 20 to 50 years from now.
What kind of things does this motorcycle include?
Well, this motorcycle includes one of the most impressive things is that in an all-electric motorcycle, there are no gears. This is an automatic motorcycle, so there's no clutch, there's no shifting. And as in other electric motorcycles, it's 100% of torque 100% of the time, meaning when you twist the throttle on a live wire, the power comes on hot and heavy. There's just nothing between the stored energy in that battery and your rear tire. And that is an amazing experience. Of course, there's no fuel burning, so it's great for the environment, as all electric vehicles are. And it's a unique riding experience because while it does make a sound, it does not make the classic Harley-Davidson sound,
right,
which has become so synonymous with the brand.
Yeah. Is that going to be okay for Harley drivers?
Well, you know, obviously it's a bit divisive. I happen to think the sound is pretty amazing. It sounds like a turbine, like almost like a jet engine whirling as it spools up. And I find it a very satisfying sound. But, you know, our traditional old school riders are, you know, they're a little, they look at it with a little bit of, they're not really so sure about it. But it's an exhilarating thing to ride. Because it's so quiet, too, it has a sort of zen-like quality to it. When you're riding, all you're really hearing is the wind noise as opposed to a motor rumbling, you know, under you. And that's a unique experience for sure.
And what part did Wilkins play in the LiveWire project?
Well, we were one of the first dealerships to adopt the LiveWire here at the dealership, which required a lot of extra training for our technicians. Obviously, the technology in the LiveWire is very different from what we know. So our technicians had gone through very extensive training to be prepared for the arrival of this. We also had to install a charging station so we can charge any EV vehicle here at Wilkins Harley Davidson, not just the LiveWire, but you know, we see our fair share of Leafs and other electric vehicles pulling up just to charge. So we're fully into the game. It's been a very interesting project for us because we've been contacted by some very interesting folks to help customize live wires for law enforcement use, which has been a really satisfying experience for us and really fun, basically taking the live wire platform and retrofitting it with unique features that are suitable for law enforcement officers.
Mm. And that's rolling out pretty soon, isn't it?
That's correct. These bikes will be shipping to the respective departments in May. In fact, one of them is going to New York City, and then there are two that are going to law enforcement at a couple of universities here in the United States.
Oh, that's exciting stuff. Now, let's talk bologna sandwiches. When did this become a Wilkins Harley-Davidson thing?
Well, again, it comes back to Harry and his wife Barbara, really, in this case, because I don't think Harry made a lot of the bologna sandwiches, but his wife Barbara sure did. Well, their dealership, as I mentioned to you, was at their home, which is in a sort of remote place. And, you know, when riders came to the dealership, there were not McDonald's and Burger Kings right down the road for them potentially to get some nourishment. So a lot of riders ended up arriving at Harry's and Barbara's place hungry. And Harry, being in tune with his guests as we are, realized that he needed to have some food on hand. And while his means weren't great, he could certainly afford to produce bologna sandwiches. So whenever a group of riders would come in at lunchtime, Barbara would get out to making bologna sandwiches. And it was a very specific recipe. And that recipe is one that we carry on today. It's simple white bread, simple bologna, and yellow mustard.
Oh, no kidding. And you said the tradition carries on still?
That's right. You know, we periodically throughout the year have bologna Saturdays here where you can arrive at the dealership and have bologna sandwiches with us to celebrate that tradition. They're not on hand every day like they were back when Barbara was making them. But we do have them, and it's certainly a nice nostalgic way to look back at yesterday and remember our roots.
I love it. Now, Mark, you are the customer experience manager. That's kind of a newfangled title for, you know, a 75-year-old Harley dealership. So what does that mean exactly?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is, I guess, the official title. I wear a lot of hats here at the dealership, but the customer experience manager component of what I do here is that we have realized that, again, as I mentioned at the opening of this, that what happens to a guest when they come here at all touch points is really, really important. From the moment they walk through the door to the moment they ride out on their new motorcycle. And what I focus on is making sure that that experience from nose to tail, if you will, is world class. We take great pains to make sure that every experience here is a personal one. It's not a cookie cutter one size fits all sort of deal. We really like to hone in on our guests and what their specific needs are, and tailor the experience to them. And I think that's partly why we have such incredible customer experience numbers with the motor company. The motor company makes sure that they track customer experience across all the dealerships nationally. And we have consistently ranked amongst the very top dealers in the country. And I think it's, well, certainly not because of me, but because we've always focused on that. Our owner, John Lyon, realized 7 years ago that he needed somebody in a position to be watching that specific aspect of the dealership, and that's when he hired me. And so I work with all of the managers here and all of the frontline people to make sure that we're offering that a consistent experience that is above what you might find somewhere else.
I love it. Mark, what was the Freedom for All project at Wilkins?
Well, the Freedom for All project, Rick, was an initiative that we launched a couple years ago where we realized, especially during the COVID time, that the experience that folks have riding a motorcycle was an incredible release and a great way to deal with life's challenges. And it seemed unfortunate to us and certainly to John Lyon, our owner, that, you know, often cost would stand in the way of somebody who could really benefit from having a motorcycle to have that experience, that release, if you will. And so John conceived this program called the Freedom for All Project, which allowed us to provide free of cost to qualified folks who could not swing the cost of a motorcycle on their own. We provided them with a motorcycle free of charge from the dealership. It was a very gratifying experience for us to see somebody get themselves on a bike and experience what we all enjoy, who probably couldn't on their own. And it was a nice way for us to give back something to the community. And the recipients were certainly completely amazed and grateful for the offer. So that's what the Freedom for All project is.
I think you had to hit certain benchmarks. You sold so many, and then another would be given away. So how many bikes did you give away to people in need?
I believe three.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a great program. Now,
indeed.
Mark, how does someone go from wanting to have a motorcycle but lacking the skill to someone who knows how to operate a bike safely?
Well, we offer a program here at Wilkins Harley-Davidson called the Riding Academy. And the Riding Academy is a really amazing program that in a 2.5-day period can transform somebody who's never even sat on a motorcycle to a safe and endorsed rider. It's very similar to what the state offers at the DMV. It's a Motorcycle Safety Foundation curriculum that we present right here at the dealership on our riding range and in our classroom. So basically, the Riding Academy was conceived to be a very small and intimate program. We realize that each rider has a unique challenge as they get to go from ground zero up. And what we wanted to do is make sure, once again, that we were providing a really personalized experience for folks as they were learning to ride. So our class size is only 6 students. That's as large as we get. It really allows us to have a student-to-teacher ratio that really provides the kind of mentoring that is required, we believe, to create a safe rider. And the program has been extraordinarily successful. We're on our 5th year or 6th year now. We train 180 students a year. And the program is comprehensive. So you come here, you get your training, you get your motorcycle permit and your endorsement all at the same time. And that is all issued here at the dealership. There's no need to go to the DMV. We work in coordination with the DMV to make sure the licensing process happens. But if you pass and earn your endorsement here, you're good to go. And it's been an extraordinary part of what we do here. It's one of my favorite things, actually.
How often is the Riding Academy offered, Mark?
We offer classes usually mid-April through the mid part or even end of October, depending on Mother Nature. Our first class this year is actually this Friday. So we'll be kicking off weather providing, and we offer classes once to twice a week throughout the season, and our schedule is completely online at our website at wilkinsharley.com. You can book a reservation right there.
And then how many classes does it usually take to get your license?
It's a 2.5-day program. So on the first day, which is a half day, we typically work on the classroom portion. And then the next 2 days are all on bike training on the riding range. Mm. And at the end of that third day, we have a testing program where we, of course, make sure that you have acquired the skills that are necessary. And then a graduation, and you're issued your endorsements that quick.
That's great. Now, we talked about this a little bit earlier when we were talking about the live wire motorcycle, the electric, all-electric motorcycle, but the Harley sound, what makes it sound exactly right, Mark?
Well, you know, it all has to do with that big V-twin motorcycle engine that is in that bike. It has always made a certain sound, and there are no other motorcycles that make this sound. But it's the design of the engine and the way it's exhausted that creates a certain sound that a lot of people like to think sounds like you're saying potato, 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 potato. See, you'll like that too, Rick, being a
food
guy. And so a lot of people think it sounds like the bike is saying potato. And of course, one of the great joys of a Harley-Davidson motorcycle is that we love to customize them and personalize them, and you can actually tailor that sound that comes out of that V-twin, depending on the exhaust that you choose for it. So some people want to hear a very pronounced sound like that. Some people want it quieter. Nonetheless, it is definitely a part of the experience of a Harley-Davidson. It's amazing to me that, you know, people come into the dealership and they want to see the colors and they want to admire the chrome. But more than anything, they want to hear what that machine sounds like. So that's completely associated with Harley-Davidson and something that our riders really enjoy.
Well, I would imagine when your mechanics work on an engine at the shop, they have to get that sound just right. Is there someone who has the ear for it and can tell, you know, when you've hit it, when it's just the right sound?
Well, you know, it's not really the technician's job. That these bikes come from Milwaukee sounding that way. You know, it's not something that we necessarily add or tune. What we can do is we can take that bass sound, which is fantastic with, you know, in its stock form, and we can enhance it, or we can sort of apply an EQ to it, if you will, and tailor it a little bit. Some people like a little bit more of a crackle in that sound. Some people like it to be a deep, thunderous rumble. And so that is where the technicians and our parts and accessories specialists can step in and say, well, what kind of sound do you want? And then the aftermarket parts that are available for the Harley-Davidsons can achieve that. So that is where our techs come in.
One more thing that I think sets Wilkins Harley apart from any other dealer is it seems like most of the employees at Wilkins have a spirit animal. Is this a thing there?
This is a thing, Rick. it was one of the surprising things to me about coming on board Wilkins Harley Davidson 7 years ago was, well, you know, I imagined, you know, a pretty rough and tumble cast of characters. And what I found really was a surprise to me, and that is that everybody here at Wilkins Harley Davidson is pretty spiritually orientated. And I don't mean in a religious sense,
sure,
but just in the sense that we're sort of in touch with our supernatural experiences in life. And as such, many of us who have been here for a while have been awarded, if you will, a spirit animal. And spirit animals are not chosen by the individuals here. They're actually given by the existing tribe of spirit animals once you have displayed your own personal characteristics. So it takes some time. after working here for a few years, and you've demonstrated who you are and what your qualities are at the dealership. The other spirit animals may induct you into the society. So it's sort of a special honor here at the dealership. I was inducted a few years back as the owl, and we have a jaguar here. We have a jungle cat. We have a mountain goat. We have an eagle. We've got a wolf. We have an Arctic fox. And all of these spirit animals really do pretty closely represent the qualities of the individuals who have them. And that's really a neat part of what we do here.
Well, you've got a great spirit animal there to represent, so represent it well. Have you taken – we only have about 30 seconds. Have you taken a keener interest in owls since you've become Mark the Owl?
Yeah, no question about it. You know, I was honored to be given that specific spirit animal. I've always felt that for some reason that owls were wise critters, and I'm not sure if I actually embody that, but it certainly was an honor to be recognized as the owl.
Might be your sharp talons. Mark Frano is the customer experience manager at Wilkins Harley-Davidson in Barrie. His spirit animal is indeed the owl. To learn more about Wilkins Harley, you can visit WilkinsHarley.com. Mark, thanks so much for sharing the Wilkins story with us this morning.
My pleasure, Rick. Thank you.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, get an update. Then we'll return to hear about some moves that could affect renewable energy accessibility in Vermont. And coming up today at 12:10, coverage of the Sox in Detroit begins, and we'll have the first pitch at 1:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Whenever gas prices shoot skyward, the country looks a little more closely at renewable energy. But in Vermont, shifting away from fossil fuels has been a goal for quite some time. But a couple of recent moves could affect our shift towards renewables. Here to explain what those are is Peter Sterling, Executive Director of Renewable Energy Vermont. Peter, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, if you've got a renewable energy question for Peter, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Peter, before we get into the discussion, give us a quick introduction to what REV is.
Sure. We're the trade association that represents all the businesses that are working in all the different areas of renewable energy here in Vermont, like the folks that install solar panels, the folks that help people drive EVs, the people that service hydroelectric dams and work on wind turbines and try to put those new battery storage units into people's homes so they can have more reliable energy.
In your assessment, how is Vermont doing in moving towards its renewable energy goals?
Well, you know, historically, we've done well. Back in 2017, we were installing a lot of solar and we were moving forward on wind power. And we actually, the renewable energy workforce at that point represented about 6% of the entire state's workforce. So we had a lot of people, a lot of regular people out there working every day to install solar panels in fields and on roofs and get wind turbines going and all those things. But since then, we've kind of taken a bit of a nosedive due to some crimping down on by the state of Vermont on the regulations that allow us to put solar panels up and things like that. So it's been a bit of a nosedive in the last few years, which is ironic because the state's goals to eliminate the use of fossil fuels and reduce greenhouse gas emissions are getting higher and higher. So at the very moment when we have laws that are telling us we need to do more to reduce our fossil fuel use, the state of Vermont's actually making it harder for us to get that our power from the sun and the wind and other renewable resources.
Are those goals realistic, Peter?
Oh, yeah. We could definitely do it in Vermont. There's no doubt in my mind that we have the technology and the workforce and the support of people to help Vermonters transition, not 100% renewable energy, because that will probably never happen, but at least get do a lot of good work to really, really reduce how much oil we burn to heat our homes, how much gasoline we use to power cars by going electric, and getting our electricity from cleaner, renewable resources like hydro and wind and solar.
And Peter, as I mentioned, when fossil fuel prices rise, we tend to see interest in renewables for home energy, for vehicles rise, as well as the use of mass transportation. Are we currently seeing a bump in interest again?
Well, you know, Vermont doesn't have a whole bunch for mass transportation. That takes a big investment of infrastructure.
Yeah.
But certainly, I think your point is well taken, Rick, that when gas, you know, I think that the critical tipping point for most folks is when it gets above $3 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you see, for at least for electric vehicles, real interest, real uptake. Because electric cars, if you do it on a mile-by-mile basis, it costs about a dollar to run a car. You know, it's the equivalent of a dollar for a gallon of gas. So, you know, electric cars are a little more of an investment up front, but they have so much less repairs and they cost so much less to operate that the money does tend to work out. It definitely looks like a much better deal when gas is over $3 or, of course, $4 a gallon.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've heard a lot about supply chain slowdowns affecting a lot of different industries. Has this been the case in the solar energy field, Peter?
Oh, I mean, Rick, I mean, without a doubt, when I talk to my members, my businesses who are trying to figure out how to get parts and solar panels so they can continue to meet the demand of Vermont, they are just absolutely, you know, they're going into a gunfight with, you know, a piece of cardboard. They got nothing. It's really, really hard. We don't have much of a domestic production industry for solar components, the panels and the parts that help get them installed. Most of it comes from China or Southeast Asia, and the supply chain is just debilitating. I've got members telling me that parts they ordered back in December now are being delayed. They're not going to get them till probably October, November, which, you know,
wow,
is a lot harder to install solar when it's, you know, there's snow on a roof and it's super cold out. So they're going to miss a lot of the construction season. And, you know, that means ultimately Vermonters aren't going to be able to get the solar they want unless things change.
Mm. Now, that's supply chain issues. Another that's affecting solar panels are tariffs. So what's being considered by the federal government there?
Well, that's a good question. So right now, there's most of our most of the solar components are made in China, but a bunch are made in Southeast Asian nations like Thailand and Vietnam and Cambodia. And the federal government is considering enacting up to a 200% tariff on all solar parts coming out of Southeast Asia, which would mean essentially all domestic businesses who are trying to install solar would see just an incredible increase in the price of all their components. It would really hamstring the whole industry around the country. So I really can't believe, you know, President Biden, who's made such a priority of reducing our reliance on fossil fuels, his administration would let this tariff go forward. But, you're talking potentially, you know, millions of dollars of added cost to Vermont businesses if this tariff was to go through, you know, spread out over all these customers. And really what that translates to, Rick, and this is why it's important, and I hope it, you know, we can keep the cost down for Vermonters, is when you're installing solar, for most people, it's a question of how long till I get a payback on this initial investment, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
In exchange for going solar, you make a big upfront payment to put all this equipment on your house, let's say, and then you get your electricity bill probably goes down to zero, which is great, but you've laid out a bunch of cash, right, or taken a loan. And the question is, how long is that payback period? And for some Vermonters, they can weather it for 10 years or 12 years. They might be willing to wait. But a lot of other Vermonters, you know, we want to make solar more accessible. You'd like to see that payback period coming down to, you know, 7 to 8 years. And the higher the cost of these panels, the longer that payback period is. And it's really more of a deterrent for more people going solar. And like I said at the opening, Rick, at the very time the state of Vermont is doing so much to get, you know, to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, we've got laws like the Global Warming Solutions Act, which mm-hmm. is saying we've got to get people into electric cars and change the way they heat their homes. We need to be, the state of Vermont and the federal government needs to be doing more, not less, to make solar power more affordable for more people.
Well, if solar is becoming a problem right now, is there much growth available for renewable energy sources other than solar in Vermont?
Well, yeah. I mean, there is the main other source of renewable energy in Vermont would be wind power. To be honest, we have a good stream of in-state hydroelectric power, but there's no new rivers left to dam. We've pretty much done all the work we can do on those, and it's a real contributor, you know, to our renewable energy needs. But the big area for growth would be wind power. But under the Scott administration, the state of Vermont has enacted the strictest wind sound regulations in the entire country. To be honest, even the FAA has less wind restrictions on those F-16 jets that fly around Chittenden County than the state of Vermont does for what the sound a wind turbine can make, which is usually pretty far from people's homes. So until we get the state of Vermont to loosen up those regulations on how we can get, you know, deploy wind resources, really solar is the only game in town, other than some biomass that we could do, you know, advanced wood heating like pellets and stuff like that for generating some electricity.
The other question, Peter, is, you know, during the pandemic, as the supply chain slowed down, especially with food, I mean, thank goodness Vermont has the infrastructure, farm-to-table infrastructure, where, you know, we could buy directly from our farmers and know where it came from and not be too affected by the supply chain. So doesn't this stimulate some kind of an idea to manufacture these solar panels in the U.S., maybe even in Vermont?
Oh, without a doubt. You nailed it, Rick. 100%. I think every one of us in the renewable energy industry would say the priority should be figuring out how we can be self-supporting, how we should have a domestic industry that leads the world in the production of everything around renewable energy. And that will take a couple of years to get plants built and stuff like that. And, you know, but until that time, we do have to rely on international suppliers. But 100%, you know, the United States should be building its own solar equipment. And to be honest, part of what you said, I think also rings true for where we get our energy. Why should Vermont have to rely on oil from Saudi Arabia or natural gas from wherever? We should be really self-reliant in energy. It makes a lot of good sense. We, you know, there's a reason Vermont has the second lowest electric rates in New England, is we've been, you know, we've taken steps that other states haven't to ensure that we're more self-reliant than others as far as long-term power contracts. So the more energy we generate in Vermont and by Vermonters, I think the more self-reliant and the more we will weather other, you know, the ups and downs of the international power or the domestic power market. So it's a good thing to save Vermonters money generating our own power.
Gotcha. Peter, we've got a couple calls, but I want to talk a little bit first about net metering. Very quickly, explain what net metering is.
Sure. Vermont was a leader and one of the leaders in the country in this. So what it says is, let's say, Rick, you want to put solar panels on your house, but it's expensive for you as a homeowner, but there's a lot of value in you generating your own power. So Vermont established a program called net metering, where when you generate your own solar, you are paid a slightly higher rate for generating your own solar, and any excess power that you have goes back to the grid. So let's say, Rick, you use 50 kilowatts a day of power, and your net metering, your solar panels on your roof make 60 kilowatts. That extra 10 goes back to the grid. And so when you get a credit for that, and when the sun isn't shining or it's nighttime and you're using electricity, you can tap into those credits to get you free electricity because you gave other electricity back to the grid. And this has enormous benefits for everyone in Vermont, because when we're generating our own power from the sun, it's basically replacing natural gas that has to be piped in from out of state. And so this net metering program has made it more affordable for many people to put solar on their roof. You know, thousands of Vermonters have taken advantage of this program to install solar in their homes and elsewhere on their property.
And what's being considered right now regarding that compensation, Peter?
Well, like we touched on just a bit earlier, you know, the supply chain has caused a lot of expensive increases. There's a potential tariff. You know, there's labor increases, but for the sixth time in 6 years, our state government, the Public Utilities Commission, is considering reducing how much Vermonters who generate their own power will get will get compensated. And basically, it's making it more expensive for people to put solar, to go solar. And right when we have a, you know, we're right in the middle of a climate crisis, I think most people would agree that our summers are getting weirder because of climate. We're getting more rain and droughts and weather's more unpredictable. Climate crisis is here. We should be doing more to stop our use of fossil fuels, not less. So this is exactly the wrong time for the state of Vermont to be making it more expensive for more Vermonters to get off of fossil fuels and go solar. And that's what's being considered right now by the Public Utilities Commission and our Department of Public Service.
All right. Let's take a call. Go to Milton first. We're joined by Jermaine. Good morning, Jermaine.
Hi there. The how long does the solar panel last, just like on the house?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the expense would be if you had to change your shingles with the solar panels already installed?
All right. Peter, can you help Jermaine with that? Yeah.
Yeah. Solar panels are productive for about 20 years, 25 years. So they'll last a real long time. You know, I haven't put a roof on, but I haven't done a roof with solar panels. So it would seem like it would take a bunch of work to, you know, go around the solar panels if you were to reshingle. I think most of the time you'd want to make sure your roof was in pretty good shape before you put panels on, but there's probably a workaround. And Jermaine, if you want to get in touch with me, I could definitely connect you with an installer who could get you an answer to that question. So, Jermaine, just go to the Renewable Energy Vermont website. My phone number is all over the place there, and my email, and we can get you in touch with someone who can answer that question directly for you.
And, Jermaine, next time I have the folks from Green Mountain Solar on, too, I'll put that question to them. It's an excellent question, so thank
you. Yeah, they're pros. They know what they're doing, so that's great, Rick.
Let's move on to Stan in Warren. Hi, Stan.
Yes, hi. I actually have two things that I'm hoping that Peter can comment on. I was a little bit surprised when he said it'd be difficult for Vermont to reach 100% alternative energy, especially with the Vermont CAP legislation, Climate Action Plan, which from what I've read implies that we're supposed to reach a goal of 40% electric usage by 2030 and 100% by 2050. Yeah. And it appears that the legislation actually opens the doors for Vermont to be sued if we don't reach those goals. So I'm curious what he thinks about the cap.
Dan, and great question. Thanks. You obviously know what you're talking about, so I appreciate that. So Stan is exactly right.
One other thing,
hold on, Peter. Let Stan ask his second question. Go ahead, Stan.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, and the second thing is there's this big push regarding wind and a kind of a secondary alternative energy source to solar. But when you're discussing wind, there's only discussions about the horizontal turbines and not the vertical turbines, which are much smaller, less of a footprint, and being smaller, less intrusive to neighbors and things like that. And there doesn't seem to be any interest in that. And I recognize the fact that they're not as quite as efficient because they're not as tall, but they're becoming much more efficient, and you're starting to see the use on such small things as bus stops for nighttime lights.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to be ignored by our alternative energy community here in Vermont.
All right, Stan. Perfect. Thanks for those questions. Peter, we got 2.5 minutes to handle some big questions from Stan, which are great. So let's talk about 100% renewables, first of all.
All right. Well, Rick, no one's ever accused me of talking too slow, so I think I can get through this.
All right, good.
So Stan's exactly right. The state law is that we need to move, we can and should be moving toward 100% renewable energy in our electric sector. So all of our electricity, he is right, should be coming from renewable resources sometime in the next 10 years. And that is very doable when you consider how much we currently get from hydropower and solar, which is considered, you know, the hydropower is considered renewable. We can do that. What I was alluding to when I made that statement was we'll probably never be 100% fossil fuel free in terms of how our our vehicles are powered and how we heat our homes. I think electric cars are becoming really become prevalent, but I think there's always going to be a role for, you know, like diesel trucks. I think we'll probably need those, into the future. And also, mm-hmm. I think we'll probably also always need some fossil fuels to heat or cool our homes. So as far as, you know, we'll always have be using some fossil fuels here in Vermont. I think we can get rid of almost all of them. But as far as the electric sector stands, exactly right. There is no reason Vermont cannot be getting all of its energy, electricity, for all the things we need electricity for, from 100% renewable resources like wind, biomass, hydro, and solar. And as far as his comment on the alternative technology for wind, yeah, I mean, technology is changing so much that we should be looking at every which way to get wind in Vermont, because wind in Vermont is an amazing complement to solar, because Vermont is windiest at night. So when the solar panels are not working at night, we could have wind power, you know, giving us renewable energy at night. But to Stan's bigger point, I got to say it out there, Rick. I think as Vermont, we owe it to everyone to generate the power we need, which does mean looking at solar panels and wind turbines, because right now where we get our power from is oil that's taken out of the ground somewhere else. We get Hydro-Québec from Canada, which means we've, you know, parts of Quebec have been flooded that are bigger than like Connecticut and Rhode Island combined. Mm-hmm. So someone's living with that impact. When we pull natural gas and have it shipped around the world to us, someone else is living with that impact. And to be honest, we get a lot of our power from nuclear down in New Hampshire. So right. Someone's going to be living next to a nuclear power plant so we can get power. What I think we as Vermonters need to do is understand we just may have to look at some wind turbines as we drive around. We have to understand that people are going to put solar panels on their roofs and in their yards. And that's, we have to live that because we want the convenience of having electricity. So I think we just have to get used to looking at these things and living with them. It's part of life. We all love electricity because it powers everything we need.
It does indeed. Stan, great call. Thanks so much. Peter Sterling, Executive Director of Renewable Energy Vermont. To learn more about REV, about what we've been discussing this morning, you can go to revermont.org. Peter, thanks for being with us again this morning.
Hey, thanks for the callers, and thanks for having me this morning, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for news, and then we're going to meet a Champlain College student who is really lighting things up. And coming up tonight at 7, we've got 2 great hours of jazz with George Thomas. Then it's Eye on the World with John Batchelor from 9 to 1 a.m. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs, including Healthcare Today and The Brady Farkas Show, on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I don't want to put any pressure on our next guest, but she comes to the show with glowing recommendations. One person said of Jess Turner, quote, "I'm not sure when or if she sleeps." The moderator of Champlain's Women in Tech Club messaged me and said, quote, "She's awesome. I'm really impressed with her insight." It is National Student Employment Month, and that's why we've invited her onto the show, and it sounds like she comes with her own fan club already. Jess Turner, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. Listeners, to ask Jess about what she's already been able to accomplish and about her career plans, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jess, where are you originally from?
I'm from Wilmington, Massachusetts, originally.
So it's just outside of Boston. And I know there aren't many colleges in the Boston area.
No, there's none, actually.
So why did you decide to come to Vermont, come to Champlain College?
Honestly, I am an only child, so I wasn't considering looking that far from home. So Champlain was the furthest college away from Wilmington that I was considering. Mm-hmm. And that was far away, like very far away in my mind. Now looking back, it's crazy because it's just a 3-hour drive. Right. And I've met people who literally are from different countries who, you know, come to Champlain. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I, for some reason, went and listened to the ITS division talk about their cybersecurity program, which is what I was originally going to Champlain for. And the program is amazing, honestly, like probably one of the best in the nation.
Yep.
Burlington's beautiful. Fell in love with the area, the architecture, the people. There's like just a really good sense of community in Burlington, I feel like.
The architecture. Jess, you just stole my heart. I am a person who loves to go to towns, go to cities, and check out the architecture. What was it about the architecture of the area that you that really stirred you?
Oh, I don't know. I really love the old Victorian mansion. So the fact that the freshman dorms at Champlain are, you know, refurbished mansions are was really cool to me. I love just all the nooks and crannies and everything about it, really.
Yeah, such character. Now, you're enrolled in the degree design lab program. What is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question, because that wasn't a thing when I first came to Champlain. So the degree design lab is kind of like an individual silo right now from Champlain. So it's not ITS, it's not EHS, it's its own division, DDL. And what it basically is like an interdisciplinary space where students can build their own degrees in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So they can choose 2 to 3 different areas of studies and combine them. So it's not just, so like, for example, I do cybersecurity and social justice. It's not those two things separately. It's what happens when those two things come together.
Well, that's very interesting. Cybersecurity and social justice. Where is the intersection between those two? I can't find it, but you did.
Where isn't it? It's so integral to, you know, technology and the work we do. Diversity, equity, and inclusion, in my opinion, should be in every field. There is. But in technology specifically, I mean, everything that happens in the tech field directs people, impacts people rather.
Mm-hmm.
Like from, we see policymakers in Congress, you know, voting on these bills, and it impacts people every day.
Right.
Companies are getting hacked. Everything that we do impacts people. So why shouldn't there be a social justice aspect within that?
Yeah, point well taken. And Jess, so with this cybersecurity and social justice that you've put together, you know, when you graduate, what do you hope to be doing?
Well, when I graduate, I'll be starting full time at New Harbor Security, which is a cybersecurity firm in Colchester, Vermont. And there I'll be doing information assurance.
So this is something you place you started, I believe, as an intern. And are you working there full time now, or not full time? Obviously, still have some school to do. But then that has led to a full time job once you graduate.
Yeah, they hired me as an intern in January of 2020, so just before the pandemic hit, which was great timing for me because I got to meet all of my lovely coworkers and kind of get a feel for the company. And then, you know, COVID hit. I stuck around. They kept me around. And I started part-time in January of 2022, so this year. And then I'll be starting full-time after I graduate. Take a little break and get some sleep for June 2022.
Oh, my gosh. Jess Turner does sleep.
I do.
Explain what that full-time position will be.
Yeah. So I'll be an Information Assurance Analyst 1, which is kind of like an entry-level position within IA. IA being Information Assurance. And so I will be providing services to our client, whether that's third-party vendor assessments, gap assessments. We have been doing incident response tabletops. And the company is really growing at a fast pace. Like even since I started, we just hit over 100 employees. And
wow.
It's exciting to see the company grow and have been a part of that, even just as an intern.
And that means you have fallen in love with Vermont so much you will be staying here?
Yeah, believe it or not, the 3-hour drive did not deter me, so I'll be sticking around.
All right, good for you. Now, the one thing that I've noticed is your resume appears a little flimsy, but let's run through some of the things you've done. Tell us about the project to help identify potential sex trafficking victims using data systems.
Yeah, so that was actually the first project I was able to work on that kind of inspired me to pursue like living in this area between, you know, technology and social justice. Mm-hmm. And that happened my first year. It was actually the first day of my first year during orientation. Professor Dwayne Dunstan, who is amazing, he was presenting to the, you know, freshmen and talking about this project he was doing. And basically, me and him, after I, you know, hopped on board, was working with a former corrections officer from the state of Florida to address this issue of inmates being, you know, victims of human trafficking. And in a state where, correct me if I'm wrong, there's only one women's, you know, correctional facility in Vermont.
Right.
That's
South Burlington.
Kind of really important to, you know, think about. And so he was presenting and I was listening like, oh my God, this guy is so cool. This project is so cool, but I don't know if I could do that. And at the end of orientation, I don't know what made me do it, but I just stood up and walked up to Dwayne and I was like, hey, I think your project's really cool. I'd love to help out. And the rest was kind of history.
If I remember correctly, Jess, at the end of my college orientation, I was trying to remember where they told us the cafeteria was. but you were coming up with this incredible project. How has that project gone?
It's gone well. I mean, you were saying my resume is kind of flimsy. So you see that.
That was a joke.
I might not have been able to stick with that one project for 4 years, but the time that I worked on it was really incredible because, like, what we were doing is building out this expert system. So taking the information that the former corrections officer has, and he knew a lot about, you know, how to look for red flags in inmates. And, like, for example, if there is a similar release address between multiple people, that can sometimes be indicative of someone being a victim of human trafficking, or like certain tattoos. So that all goes into a system. So that's like a data set. And the application we were writing was able to parse through all of those different pieces of data and pick out the ones where might be a red flag.
Wow.
So I wasn't able to see it to completion, but the piece that I worked on was incredible. And I know that project didn't stop when I stopped working on it, at least.
Yeah. Now, another thing you've done is you created a course that weaves together the world of cybersecurity with feminism. So what is that course?
Yeah, that's actually my senior capstone project. So still ongoing. So I still need to submit my proposal for that. But that one is really near and dear to my heart because I think it really puts together what I've been working towards in my 4 years, which is there needs to be more diversity in technology, and we need to really be thinking about how to better the field in itself. And after doing a crap ton of research, I came to the conclusion that that's teaching students technology through a feminist lens, which kind of centers identity as like the main perspective there and is able to say like, okay, if we're looking at the system of technology in the field itself, what in it is, I don't want to say broken, but like not there yet. Like forever, the field has been dominated by predominantly white men. Mm-hmm. Not to say that there hasn't been diversity, but like, for example, in cybersecurity, women only make up 24%. Of the workforce, and that is extremely low.
Right.
So kind of teaching people about how gender plays a role in the field, the workplace, even in like the size of your iPhone or like how AI systems sometimes don't recognize black faces. Hmm. All of that is really important to recognize and do better as we make new software, new systems, and market new products.
Is this a course that could be part of the Champlain curriculum eventually and one that maybe you could teach and keep you in Vermont longer? Just saying.
Yeah, that's my hope. so we'll see.
We're still in the middle of that resume, Jess. You've made the president's list, getting a 4-0. How many times?
I don't know.
Lost count. You've also been featured. last week, you were featured at a student spotlight event. As we mentioned, you started with New Harbor Security as an intern. Then a part-time job, a position awaits you upon graduation. A member of Women in Technology since freshman year. Have I missed anything in your 4 years at Champlain College?
Well, the only other thing I'd say is I've been a part of TechRun, which is a student-run nonprofit based out of Vermont, but, you know, stemming from Champlain. So that is the other piece that I've been doing all these years.
Mm-hmm. What's that again?
TechRun, and it's like tech for children, like TechRun. So that was, you know, a nonprofit started by some students, and what we do is we take donated technology, like old laptops or phones, tablets, whatever you got, and we refurbish it and then donate it to people who don't have that technology or need it, / you know, want some new tech.
Is there anything that you have failed to accomplish in your 4 years at Champlain that you had set a goal to do?
Maybe get 8 hours of sleep every night.
And are you enjoying it? That's the other thing. You know, we do hear a lot about the pressures, you know, and the mental health concerns with college students. You've put a lot of pressure on yourself. You've attempted to accomplish quite a bit, and you've been successful at it. But do you make sure that you're taking care of yourself mentally?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I won't lie. Like, a lot of the time, I do have so much going on that it can be hard to remember to do simple things like sleep and, you know, eat and generally be well. But this last year specifically, you know, after COVID, and I think that part of the pandemic that, dare I say, was good was that it shed kind of a spotlight on mental health and everyone, not just students, but, you know, working professionals and children. So I think that gave a lot more empathy for others to be able to start saying, like, hey, this is way too much on me right now. Like, can I get an extension? Which is silly because people do that all the time, but that's, I'm not the type of person who will ask for something like that. So in short, I've learned to be able to do that for myself after, you know, having all of these wonderful opportunities come up.
Yeah. And you mentioned the pandemic, which is an added pressure for any college student. How has it been matriculating during this pandemic?
Well, it's been really interesting. I won't lie. It's kind of nice to take class from bed sometimes. But, you know, like, you do miss out on a lot of opportunities, like seeing your classmates in person. Or, like, I worked, I forget even how long I was remote for my job, but you don't get to see your coworkers. You don't get to be in office for lunch. Or, like, for example, like, Women in Technology Club, I'm the current president, but when that was happening, I think I was the vice president. It's hard to remember because the pandemic has been going on for so long. Like, right. It was 2020 when that started. So, like, we had to roll over, and everyone had to kind of adapt to figure out how we live and continue on doing things virtually, whether that be meeting for a club or having class virtually or doing labs, and if you can't access, like, the computer labs, for example. Mm-hmm. So lots of adapting happening.
Now, Jess, you have, honestly, you've drained every ounce out of this college experience. What advice would you give to students who are getting ready for college, who've got, you know, the next 4 years ahead of them, to try to accomplish the type of things you have been able to do?
I would say don't be afraid of looking dumb and not saying yes to an opportunity. Like, honestly, I think back to what I was saying in that orientation day and how I got up to speak to Dwayne. Like, I was feeling kind of shy to be doing that and nervous to be the only student out of the whole group to be able to stand up and say, I think that was cool. I'd love to work on this with you. Mm-hmm. And I would just say, don't be afraid of judgment from others, because if you really feel like something is good for you and you go out of your way and say yes, then that is a trickle effect and will grant you opportunities down the line, whether those internships or projects to work on or courses that you know, you get the bill. So it, I would definitely say yes, but don't forget to take care of yourselves.
It's interesting that you can kind of identify that moment of overcoming shyness of something that kind of set you on a really positive forward path. Did that kind of then, you know, set your course, help you do that again and again, overcome the shyness to a point where you're no longer shy? You could run for vice president of Women in Tech and president and become who you are right now.
Yeah, at a certain point, you just kind of hit a spot where you're like, I just don't really care anymore. Like, this is, I think this is cool. I'm just going to go for it. And glad I did.
Yeah. Now, Jess, is there any truth to the rumor that the Wilmington Apple has created a special Jessica Turner section to cover all of your accomplishments?
Well, I'm not aware of this. So if it is, I certainly don't know.
The Wilmington Apple, can you explain to people what that is?
Sure. It's the local Wilmington sort of news hub. So oftentimes, like, if students get, you know, a spotlight at their college or in high school, or they make president's list, they kind of highlight those things. So I would assume that's what that is referring to.
Yeah, you've made it in there several times, to put it mildly. Let's talk about cybersecurity. This is something, you know, it's part one of the majors areas of expertise for you now, and it really is come into clearer focus for people over the last number of years. But explain what the field is and how, you know, what interested you about it.
Yeah, cybersecurity as a field is, you know, has been up and coming for a while. Is probably, this is very biased of me to say, one of the most important jobs that you can have right now, especially in the time of war happening right now between Russia and Ukraine. Mm-hmm. There's cyber warfare and, you know, lots of, you know, threat groups that are trying to get your information. So cybersecurity is super important, and the work that I do in information assurance can sometimes often be overlooked, I feel like. But, you know, again, bias saying this, but I would
argue explain what that is, because I don't know exactly what your specific area does. And we've got a couple minutes for you to explain that to us.
Right, information assurance.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, the way that my team often puts it is information assurance is a larger umbrella where cybersecurity falls under. So the work that we do is thinking about security for, you know, different institutions, companies, clients at a larger scale, and looking at like a holistic approach to making sure that you have certain security tools in place for your network. You know, you have the policies in place for access controls or physical security. So you want to make sure that you have all of your bases covered and make sure that everyone's on board. So I do sort of auditing and consulting work within cybersecurity to make sure that companies and our clients are compliant with these different security frameworks, which is like governing how you're supposed to, like best practices in the field.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we don't have to go back too far to remember when I think it was Burlington Electric Company did have a cyber attack from Russian hackers that really called into play how important what you and New Harbor are doing.
Yeah, if you're not looking at your security policies and not making sure that you have all your ducks in a row, you know, it's not like if it'll happen, it's when.
Yeah.
When you'll get hacked, when you're going to have a security or a data breach.
Yeah. Jess Turner is a senior at Champlain College studying cybersecurity and social justice, and Student Employment Month might have been invented just to celebrate her. Jess, best of luck in your final semester and in your career, and thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great talking to you.
All right. Best of luck, Jess. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update. Then we'll be back to learn about Little Pataca. And coming up today at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. My parents gave us kids a good childhood. I grew up in a neighborhood where somebody's parent was always around to keep an eye on us, even if we were playing baseball at the Diamond or Army up in the woods. And the friendships that developed then are still very strong. As a matter of fact, I just went to a concert with one of those dear friends from my neighborhood last week down in Boston. If I could change anything, it would have been exposure to more languages, culture, and, yes, foods. Those lessons that we learn early on, including the acceptance of other religions, cultures, and traditions, stay with us forever. So I think that's what my next guest has in mind with the creation of Little Pataka. Joining me now to discuss it is Akshata Nayak, the founder and chief product officer of Little Pataka. Akshata, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. How are you? Thank you so much for having me here today.
I'm wonderful. It's great having you. Listeners, to ask Akshata a question about what she's created, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, email address vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I was going to say Little Pataka. You've already got me started on this.
You're welcome. You're welcome to hop on board our website. No problem.
Hey, do you remember what happened a year ago yesterday?
No.
It was you launched.
Oh, yes. Okay. I was like, with me or in Vermont in general? Yes, we launched our Kickstarter campaign last year and officially went out into the world. Yes.
And it was a Kickstarter campaign for Little Pataka. So who or what is Little Pataka?
Little Pataka. Pataka means firecracker. Mm-hmm. In Hindi. And so little firecrackers, that's what kids are, right? They're so full of potential. They just need a spark of encouragement. Yeah. And so Little Pataka is a children's media company that I started. We're based in Jericho. And I launched this in the middle of the pandemic to help create books, games, puzzles, and other types of interactive media for kids with the focused intention of improving the diversity in the imagery and the storylines and characters, as well as addressing some of the stereotypes that tend to exist within the children's media world.
And why did you decide to launch it using Kickstarter?
For me, I think it was just the uncertainties of the time with the pandemic. I also, with my husband, own Alternative Roots Wellness Center in Essex Junction. And because of the pandemic, he's a chiropractor. We're both nutritionists. We had to close the clinic down. So we were not sure of when we'd be able to start up again. And so there was a lot of financial uncertainty for us personally. And in general, even in my extended family, there was a lot of financial uncertainty like there was across the rest of the world. And so I had this idea. I had worked with my illustrators to develop the book, the illustrations, get everything ready. But then to print it and actually launch it, I was not sure. One, if people would be interested, and two, if they were, how do I make this happen? Because you need to order like thousands of copies.
Right.
And so instead of trying to put together money just from, you know, friends or family or going to a bank, which again, there was just so much financial uncertainty for everybody, I decided to just take this out into the world, let people know what I'm doing, and see what the response was, to judge whether this is actually something I can do viably or not. And the response completely stunned me. I was trying to raise $10,000, which I had figured out was like the minimum amount I needed to print these two books I had designed with my illustrators. It introduced two Indian languages, Konkani and Hindi, and made them accessible to everybody with like phonetic cues and online audio files. And I was really surprised that we raised that $10,000 in under 5 days when I was launching a whole new brand with this Kickstarter. It wasn't like the brand existed and these were new products I was launching and we had, you know, a huge mailing list or anything. Everything was new. And we crossed that. And by the time we were done, we had raised over 160% of what I originally wanted to raise. Mm. And so it completely stunned me that there was such a response. And the other thing that was surprising was Kickstarter average pledges are usually around $25. It's a crowdfunding site. Mm-hmm. So you tend to pledge money and you say for, you know, $25, I will pre-order one book. For $50, I will pre-order two books. Like all of that is laid out.
Right.
And the average pledge is $25 and ours was $132.
Oh, my.
People were surprised, you know, people were supportive and they were supportive in a big way. And so that was extremely encouraging for a tiny little business just starting out with a whole new idea.
What a firecracker that little Pataka is.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, explain how you go about trying to achieve the goal or mission of Little Pataka.
Yeah, so Little Pataka was actually inspired by my daughter. When she was born, she, at the beginning of the pandemic, like literally the day after her second birthday is when the world shut down. So, but I remember when she was born telling her, you know, you're a little Pataka, you're going to have a big impact. I know it. And so she inspired the entire idea. And I actually started out wanting to make just one book for her in my native South Indian language of Konkani, because there are no children's books in Konkani. Until recently, it didn't even have an official script. So it was passed down mostly orally from generation to generation. So I wanted her to have something. And so I started creating for her. And then I realized, you know what, there aren't many resources for other Indian languages. And so I decided to look at Indian languages as a whole. But then as the pandemic happened and progressed, I noticed that, especially with the incredible rise in the racial justice movement that had horrific origins, but it was so inspiring and powerful to see so many people stand up and demand that something be done. It made me reflect on my own experiences living in this country for close to 2 decades now.
Mm-hmm.
And realized that there were still many conversations and experiences that needed to be addressed. And so it sort of expanded the idea of doing just languages to becoming much more. And with my daughter at home and seeing how her normal is so different from my normal when I grew up, I decided to sort of look at children's media. And I noticed I'm a biochemist and nutritionist by education. So research is something that inherently comes very quickly to me. So I started doing research and dove into, you know, all kinds of information that is out there and what has been done over the past few decades. And realized that actually at the age of five, by the age of five, social biases have set in about race and gender and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And if these are not addressed during this time, between 0 to 5 years of age, those attitudes can last further into adulthood. But if you have inclusive messaging at that time, these attitudes can change within just a few weeks because children are very open and receptive to information.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where all of this came from. And so I decided to put this brand together where we offer products like books, games, puzzles, stickers, magnets, different ways that kids interact with media. And we created the two books that used language as a way to understand another culture, another country. And we will continue to expand that to include other languages from around the world. And then the other idea we had was we need to make sure we address some of these stereotypes that exist within children's media. And right now, boys are twice as likely to be heroes, while girls are twice as likely to use magic to solve problems. And that, to me, as a scientist, a nutritionist, a business owner, a woman of color, an immigrant, a mentor in my community, that was insulting to me on multiple levels. And so I needed to do something about that. So for that, we have, in fact, a new product where we've created a jigsaw mix and match puzzle where we have illustrations of professions with different diverse characters, so kids can see that you shouldn't be defined only by what you look like or even necessarily only by what you do. So, you know, things like that, very subtly yeah. bringing these ideas in that people have nuances, there are layers to different people, and it's important to notice, accept, and celebrate differences. So, you know, that's another example. Another idea was making sure that we improve representation, not only in the product, but also behind the scenes. Because right now, there are more books that have animals as the main characters than all of the minorities combined in the product. And if you look at behind the scenes, the directors, the creators, the writers, illustrators, it's mostly not from the minority or marginalized communities. And that's why this type of lack of representation exists. And so we are making sure we collaborate with all of these marginalized communities to bring their true perspectives to these stories rather than imagining what our perspective should be of theirs. So that's kind of how we are creating all of these different products right now.
Akshata, what has been the reaction of parents and of children to Little Pitaka?
I think it's been very encouraging for sure. I've had wonderful local businesses here in Vermont that have supported me. Phoenix Bookstores, The Flying Pig, they're carrying the products. Sweet Clover Market in Essex is also carrying some of the products as well. We have books, we have some coloring books, we have stickers and postcards. And so far it's been very nice to see parents and kids reach out to me and let me know how nice it has been to see Indian languages presented in a way that they're accessible to everybody because of the written phonetics and the access to online audio files. Literally anybody can pick up the books and learn two new languages. I've been very thrilled by the response I've received from Konkani families who up until now haven't really had a book that they can share with their kids about their own language, about what they grew up speaking. And, you know, when you live in a country or which is different from where you grew up, some of these things tend to slip away a little bit. And so it's nice to have these resources to introduce what you grew up with to the next generation as well, because some of these languages, like Konkani, if they aren't shared, if they aren't kept alive, then, you know, they're going to disappear in a generation or two. And so it's important to make sure we preserve them. So I think that has been the most exciting response for me, is seeing how even American parents have gotten in touch with me and said, you know, this is a whole new way for kids to see alphabets. Mm-hmm. Normally the languages that are spoken here more frequently, they still use the Roman letters written, you know, how you write English, they use those letters to even write other languages. But a language like Hindi has its own native script that has been preserved over centuries. And so to have kids look at that and see that language can be expressed in so many different ways and there are different scripts, that's very exciting. Another thing someone pointed out to me was how these two languages, though they're from one country, they're so different. One didn't have an original, a native script until recently. Another one has had it preserved over, you know, centuries, like I said, Hindi. Mm-hmm. And then some words are similar, but some are so different. So it's a great way to show that even within one country, there are so many nuances and so many differences. And so I think that that has been really fun to explore with kids and with parents as well. So those have been really great. For me, something that really made me very happy was to see, walk into a local store here and see my books available. Never, like even 2 years ago, I would have never imagined that something that had Konkani and Hindi on it would be like a staff pick at one of these stores in Vermont, right? It's not in my wildest dreams. And so it's very exciting to see how people have embraced this idea so lovingly and so easily.
That is so beautiful. Why is it important in your mind for children to have books that show other children like them or other children different than them?
I think both of those are vitally important. In fact, some of the research that I had found had clinical, they had psychologists that spoke about how seeing characters that look like you, it inspires confidence, which is a leadership quality. Inspiring that in children is very important. And seeing characters that look like others can nurture compassion and empathy. And I think confidence, empathy, compassion are qualities we should all hope for as we're growing up, or even as adults, we have to strive for them. And so I think that's why both of these become so important, to make sure that we preserve them. And kids, I think, inherently have them when they're really young. They're so proud of things that they do, however ridiculous they might be. And we tend to lose that over a period of time. So the idea is to make sure we keep that rooted and understand that representation is important, not only for those who see ourselves reflected, but for everyone. So we can all see different possibilities. And I think that that is vital. So we start reflecting in all different ways of life what society actually looks like. And I think that that's just beautiful to do and see and be able to offer now.
Well, talking about confidence and accomplishment, I would be remiss if I didn't mention, you already talked about Alternative Roots Wellness Center, which you have in Essex Junction. You also launched about a decade or so ago Orange Owl, which lasted for a decade. So what was Orange Owl?
Yeah, so this is, you know, one of those things where you say it's a fine line between confidence and crazy. My husband, Greg, and I moved to Vermont, where we knew nobody, and we started two new businesses. Not something I would recommend for the faint-hearted. So the first few months were certainly difficult as we started sort of reaching out and letting people know that we existed in this state. But once we reached out into the community, we have found nothing but support. So that's very nice. The Orange Owl was a vegan skincare company that I ran. It launched in 2010, and I closed it just as the pandemic started. And all of those recipes, I guess one way to use my biochemistry background was to create all of every recipe that was sold in that company. I created it. I used to make every single product by hand. And it was a successful kind of business, which was in about 60 stores in the Northeast and shipped across the country for orders online. And so it was a beautiful and exciting journey for me, but one that did come to an end because of health issues I had before the pandemic hit. And then once the pandemic hit, just the uncertainties, orders dropped. We didn't know what was happening with the clinic. We weren't sure if orders would pick back up. And my daughter was home because daycare closed. So all of that just made it really difficult for me to keep the production going because it was such a labor-intensive situation. And I couldn't hire anybody because we weren't sure what was going on. And so I decided to close it. One of the most gut-wrenching decisions I ever made. But certainly something that has led to another beautiful business now, and I think a business that has the potential for enormous impact and good purpose. So definitely, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur, and I'm glad I decided to make that change.
And we've got about a minute left, Lakshada, but what are you enjoying about this new chapter with Little Pataka?
I think trying to figure out how to keep kids engaged and trying to see the world from their eyes. And I see that a lot. Like, I pay more attention to what my daughter's doing, like in minute details, the things that she likes or what she says her friends like. Just looking at the world from their perspective is just amazing and so lovely. And I'm glad that I'm able to do this and I have the unconditional support and a, you know, family that's allowing me to do this. So yeah, I think that that's been the most fun for me, is just trying to see the world from their eyes so I can create products that engage them.
Lakshada Nayak is the creator and chief product officer of Little Pataka. To learn more, you can visit littlepataka.com. Lakshada, thank you so much for sharing the story of that little firecracker with us this morning.
Thank you, Rick. This is wonderful.
All right. Take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Feel free to suggest guests or topics for the show by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at the WDEV at wdevradio.com. And the podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we talk about land surveying, contra dancing, the Sci-Fi and Fantasy Expo, and bow ties.